Greetings and welcome. This is JP. I'm speaking from Northern Scotland. And tonight on Journeys, I have a very special guest. I've got a British guest for a change. It's always nice to have fellow Brits on the show, and especially because Ben has an accent that just reminds me of home. He comes from my hometown, London, and it's a pleasure to have him on. Ben was a child actor. We're going to be talking about some of Ben's history as well, because it's all relevant. And has recently made a name for himself by exposing the security scandal at the London Olympics, and showing them up for being a complete backhanders scam for what they are. So, without any further ado, no, we're not saying goodbye, we're saying hello. Without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Ben. Good evening, how are you?
Hi, JP, it's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. So let's talk about, you know, because people across the States, some people in Britain will remember you for some of the parts that you played, and certainly the Cook Report was something that was very very prominent at the time, you know, and you used to do undercover work for them when you were a teenager. This is, you know, you've got absolutely fascinating story. So do you want to tell us about, how did you get into, like, the media and all that kind of stuff?
Well, it was when I was 10 years old. My sister and I, you know, we have our holidays and what have you, and I had nothing to do through the holidays. I mean, I do things with the Cubs and Scouts and do all that kind of weekend stuff, but in the week there was very little to do, you know, and it wasn't like TV and all cable and everything to do like that.
You more or less fell into it because your sister just wanted to get rid of you for the summer. That's brilliant. I love that.
You know, she threw me down the stairs. I sort of amused me as much as possible, but then I was just annoying to her, right? So, you know, it's crazy.
So she pushed you out into the world, and we should be thankful for that, really. So you did some acting, and then did you go to the drama school from then?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, from the age of 10, really, I was doing lots of local theatre, professional local theatre, and going all around the country when I was a teenager, doing tours and where have you, going abroad and doing different shows and commercials and TV spots, and various dramas and what have you, and sitcoms. So then really it comes to a point in your acting career where you kind of need to get some formal training in. And so I went to the Sylvia Young Theatre School, and which was London's top child acting school. If you've watched EastEnders, most of the children that appeared on EastEnders came from the Sylvia Young Theatre School. And they'd go in as sort of teenagers, and they'd grow up during the soap, you know, and everyone would see them and what have you. And it's the same, there was a series here called Grange Hill for many years, which was about kids at school. It was a school kids program. And all the children from Grange Hill pretty much came from Sylvia Young Theatre School. I know there was a couple of other theatre schools, but Sylvia Young's really had the edge over everybody in the business. So I wanted to go to the best place. Sylvia Young's was the best place. So I went there and did a year's sort of student foundation course, which was great because you got to sing and dance all day and do acting workshops and all this kind of stuff. But then also I'd be represented by the agency of the school, which is really why I was there, really, and go for auditions. They put you up for various TV things, and that's how I spent my time. I'd do about 4 or 5 auditions a week, and I worked constantly, which was a really great thing. So, you know, the Cook Report and how I got into sort of investigative journalism was an accident, bearing in mind that I was a child actor. I got to sort of the age of sort of 17, 18, and a family friend said, look, you know, do you want to do an acting job? No, I didn't know that was going to be for the Cook Report, and I didn't realise it would have such a big impact on my life, obviously.
Yeah, right.
So that's really how it sort of how it came about. So really, you know, I was an actor, that's how I was setting myself up, and that's what I was doing. I had no intention whatsoever of exposing anything, you know. I didn't want to be a journalist, it wasn't something that was on my horizon, until I had that opportunity to go and work with the Cook Report, and I woke up, literally, to how the world was, and how politics worked, because the first job that I was put on was the Cash for Questions scandal, which was a really big deal here in the UK, where politicians were being paid via political lobbying companies, and one particular called Ian Greer Associates, who we were doing the sting operation on, were sort of funneling money to politicians to ask questions in the House of Commons on behalf of huge corporations, you know, and stuff like that. So it's sort of bypassing democracy, in other words. And we were going to expose this, and along with, you know, dodgy politicians and what have you. And so that's what really, that's why I woke up, really, because I knew how the politicians spoke about us. I'd met several of them during the course of the filming. And, you know, we were set up to be part of the sting operation. So I was a very young assistant to a businessman. And the producer told me, she said, look, Ben, I know you're 17, 18, but if any of these people ask you how old you are, just say that you're 15. And I said, okay, fine, that's not a problem. It was kind of, I didn't really know why at the time. It was only later that it kind of dawned on me as I got into the program that actually what we were dealing with was a larger section of gay men, and they thought that having a mixed-race boy with them who was 15 would grease the wheels as far as getting involved with these people went. So that's really why I was there. I didn't really realise that until a significant moment, you know, which came when I was in the office of Ian Greer and I met Ken Clark. And I don't really want to go too much into that because, you know, I've made a statement to the police and there is a police investigation going. So yeah. I don't.
And it's already on your website.
Yeah, exactly. And there's things out there on the internet all about it as well. I just feel that I don't want to sort of jeopardise anything the police are going to do, because obviously when this breaks in the, you know, mainstream media, because it's going to, I've been having journalists call me up the past couple of days and what have you. So I don't want to prejudice anything, because I'd hate for the police to come back and say, well, you see, you can't get a fair trial now because you've blabbed all over me. And I'd hate that. I'd go from, you know, that wouldn't be good. So I can't go into too much detail. But, you know, I was groped in the office by Ken Clark. And that's a matter of fact, and, you know, and what have you. So that's why I made the police statement, not because, you know, I want revenge or anything like that. I'm not trying to ruin anyone's career. It was simply the fact that, you know, when Jimmy Savile scandal broke here, they basically said it's Jimmy Savile, it's the isolated guy, and that's it. And I went, well, hold on a minute. You know, I've worked for the BBC as an actor. And I know what it's like. I was there as a child actor. And I tell you, as a child actor in this business, you know, I was very, I sort of, you know, I've said I ran the gauntlet of paedophiles and abusers and all that kind of stuff, but it really was like that. And you have to be very careful. Now, I was lucky, I think, but a lot of other people were, and they fell into various traps along the way with these people, because it's very easy. I mean, people think of the casting couch and they laugh. And that's purposely done to you, because people want you to believe that it doesn't really exist, that it's a myth, and it really isn't. You know, Bette Davis tells this wonderful story when she was 90, I think over a governor's mansion dinner in LA, and someone asked her about her career and how wonderful it was, and she went, listen, darling, this is she had to basically go into a producer's office, I think it was on the MGM lot, and sleep with the producer to get his part in a particular film. So she did that, and then this producer got fired in the morning, and a new guy was implanted in the afternoon, and he called her in, and if she wanted to do the movie, she had to sleep with him as well, you know. Yeah, and so this is a story that she told about herself, and I went, well, hold on a minute, you know, if it was like that in her day, Jimmy Savile was there, and look, if it was like this in the 90s, when I was a child actor, and, okay, it was different. It wasn't, you know, it was more parties and drugs and alcohol, and yes, people would try and stick their tongues down your throat, and you'd escape and all this kind of stuff. I mean, I've always said, you know, had I been gay, I think, you know, I would have definitely have been sucked further in. But because I wasn't, I was kind of known as kind of a flirty guy who they'd like to have around, and I was fun and all that kind of stuff. But I was sort of left alone a lot of the time. So I was never abused. It wasn't like those poor kids in the Wales Children's Home or anything like that. This was kind of, you know, more sort of, you know, dirty old men groping and all that kind of stuff and just trying to kiss you all the time, what have you, while you're at a party. Now, if you're a consenting adult, I have no problem with that. That's fine. But because, you know, I was often 13 or 14, you know, suddenly you don't know what you're doing. And these people are in positions of power. I mean, when you get anybody in the entertainment industry is vulnerable, really, when they first go into it, because you get all these people around you in positions of power. You don't know how much power they have. And, of course, they, you know, as I was said, when I was doing one series for the BBC, the producer said to me, look, you know, if you basically sleep with me, I can make you a presenter on a huge children's television show at the time that the BBC did. And, you know, and of course I didn't do it, so of course I didn't get the opportunity to be on that show. And that's how it's used. And so what you tend to find is that sort of the gay kids will kind of be sucked into this world a lot further, whereas sort of I was kind of left alone pretty much most of the time. So I had a story to tell. So when the Jimmy Savile story broke, I kind of said, look, it's the BBC as a culture this exists in, but also it's the wider industry, and it isn't just television. I've also worked in theatre, and the same problem happens in theatre, because obviously actors and producers and directors go from television to theatre in and out. You know, like Sam Mendes, you know, made movies, but he also did theatre projects, and of course I'm not casting any aspersions on Sam Mendes, but it's simply an example. So, you know, and I said, well, you know, it's everywhere, really. And it's also in the theatre. I actually had an experience in politics, and the first time I met powerful politicians, they groped me. That's basically, I was angry, you see, JP. So I kind of went, you know what, that's my story, and that's why I'm going to tell my story. And, of course, because I told my story, then it went into the mainstream in some way, with the Express running the article and what have you. And so then the police came to me saying, look, you know, who are the names that you've mentioned to the papers? And so I obviously, I had to give it to the police because the police could not have them, you know. And so that's how sort of the police came into it. And when I told the story about Ken Clark and what happened to him in the office, they said, look, you know, this you can report this, and you know, and we urge you to make you know, a statement about it, because, you know, what do we want to accept in our society? Do we want to accept that, you know, men can grope anyone they like, you know, or people can do these kind of things? And I kind of thought about it, and I went, look, you know, I'm not emotionally traumatized by it. It was an event. It happened. Yes, I was incredibly uncomfortable at the time, and yes, you know, but I wasn't scared or anything. I was just freaked out. You know, this was just a disgusting moment that happened. You know, do I feel like I want to make a statement? And I kind of went, you know, and you weigh up all the things in your mind over, you know, for a couple of days. And I came to the conclusion that I don't want, you know, my niece to be sitting on a bus one day and having some guy sitting next to her and groping her, you know, and getting away with it. You know, my mom told me a story when she was a young woman. I think she must have been about, you know, what, 14 or 15, young girl. And she was on the bus, and she got groped, and she was afraid to tell her mom that what happened, because she didn't tell the conductor. And her mother had always told her and said, look, you know, if anything happens, you tell the conductor. Well, she hadn't done that, so she was afraid that my nan, basically, was going to be upset with her. You know, I don't want my kids to live in that world, you know, again. You know, so that's unacceptable as far as I'm concerned. So what happened to me was unacceptable, and if I can kind of go out there and say, look, you know, I know these people are very wealthy, I know they're extremely powerful, but you know what? When they do something wrong, you do actually have to stand up and say, because what's the conversation now, especially in the UK, has been sort of hijacked, really, sort of from paedophiles and all that kind of stuff, to kind of people getting away with things, and sort of the conversation is being twisted into sort of, you know, freedom of the press issues and what have you. Where it started off as a whole bunch of paedophiles in the BBC, et cetera, and the wider industry. So really, I just wanted to say, look, I'm going to stand up. I'm going to stand up for myself. I hope when I do that other people may come forward and tell their stories. I can't, otherwise I'd be a hypocrite. I'd be writing all these articles on the internet and about, you know, stories and what have you, but not having the kind of courage to stand up to what I've written. And I thought, well, it's true, and as long as it's true, do it. So that's why, really, that I'm standing up. It's not because, you know, I've been made to do it or anything like that. No. This has come to me because of what I've written, and I'm standing behind what I've written because it is the truth. And so we're going to see, is the truth good enough? When King Clark wants to go to court, we'll see. you know, at least win, lose or draw, as it were, I'll have done the right thing. And in my mind and in my heart, that's all the thing I have to live with. That's all. I'm the only person I have to satisfy as far as that's concerned. And as long as I do the right thing, I'm a free person, you know. It's doing the wrong thing that kind of imprisons you in your own sort of psyche and misery, do you know what I mean? So that's kind of how I kind of got into it and what's gone on and why, you know, I came out and said the things that I've said and done the things that I've done.
Ben, I, you know, from myself and I, you know, on behalf of our listeners here, also, you know, from SJ, who's that's Sunshine Jim. He's saying, "Good guest, JP. Thank him for us." And you know, I really want to applaud you for standing up, basically, because there is a vast amount of money, legal action, legal muscle behind all these corporations and these politicians. However, the time has come for these people to be exposed. You know, a lot of people are talking about the apocalypse and the revelations and stuff like that, but they're not getting it. Apocalypse means the uncovering, and this is what is being uncovered. You are you're peeling back that layer of canvas, along with David Icke. You know, he's got his stuff about the green things, but the rest of his stuff is absolutely spot on. So,
what's happening? I knew this was sort of coming in a way. Because, you know, when I, you know, look, it's almost like I've been out of phase in my life, right? And I didn't know why, you know. I struggled to get into the industry that I wanted to be in. I then struggled when I was in it. And it's kind of now, it's kind of, things are making sense to me. So this new era that's coming, you know, and this obviously is the transition as we go into this thing, that this uncovering is going to happen. You know, when I went into the Olympics during the summer, I had no idea that I would be the only investigative journalist in the training at G4S. I thought it was such an obvious thing to do. But I thought, you know what, every paper or something or TV companies from around the world, because obviously the Olympics is a world event, are going to have their guys in there, and I'm not going to have a story because I won't own it, the story, right?
And you were the only one. Yes. Unbelievable. 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 So, let's go to G4S. So, do you want to tell the story to our American cousins of your experience, basically, this summer?
Well, you know, G4S is a terrible company, I have to say that from the outset, right? And they had all sorts of problems all over the world. What happened was that sort of back in the sort of the early 90s is that security companies were consolidated. And G4S, which came out of a company called Securicore, basically got a whole bunch of financing, and this is actually under Cash for Questions. This is one of the companies that actually benefited from Cash for Questions as they were formed and called G4S. And I said to someone years ago, I said, look, you know, what does the four stand for in the logo? And they said, that's the dollar sign, right? And I thought, yeah, that's all they're about, really, is making money. So what they do is they do security, where it's kind of like they drive the vans around and they collect money from different companies, businesses in towns, which is probably where a lot of people in America have probably seen them, because they've got huge cash collection business in America. And, of course, the guards there are armed, so they carry guns. I'll come back to that in a minute, because that's quite significant. And then they have sort of close protection unit, which is actually a military mercenaries unit. And these guys fight in Afghanistan and Iraq and all over the world, and they also do diplomatic protection and what have you. It's one of the services that governments are farming off and what have you. And so G4S is that private security company. So they do everything, and including the doorman who stands on the nightclub door and stuff like that. So I was interested in them because I had experienced them back in the early 90s when they were formed, and I'd learned a lot because I was around Cash for Questions and what have you, and it was discussed a lot. And so I kind of wanted to say, well, look, you know, G4S, I keep reading the paper, you know, terrible things. I think one guy who just joined G4S was given a gun and he immediately shot himself in the foot, you know, for training. Or the training he got was so bad, you know, it was, you know, there was another guy who was on drugs who decided to shoot his fellow workers in the van as they were driving around. I mean, and, you know, there was a guy, which really got me, there's a guy's mother and he was a soldier in Iraq, and he had he was in the British Army, and he had post-traumatic stress disorder, and she said that he was not fit to go back into theatre of operations. It just wasn't, you know, he shouldn't have been there. However, he leaves the army. G4S immediately takes him in, because that's what they do. It's the British Army feeds G4S with personnel, as well as, you know, all the other, you know, militaries around the world. You know, they're not just a UK base. They've got Americans and Australians and all sorts of Europeans and what have you. And what happened was, this soldier who they then sent back into Iraq, basically got drunk one night in a bar, came out with his two of his colleagues, because they can drink while they're there. They're not, you know, part of any country or something like that. Like, our soldiers in the UK are dry when they go into theatre operations. G4S, because they're a private corporation, they can do what they like. So he came out of a bar drunk, and he actually shot his two colleagues, two fellow soldiers. And then he shot himself. And there's no justice for this whatsoever. It's just swept under the carpet. G4S pretty much didn't even admit to even this incident happening until someone put it out in the press, and it kind of got gathered momentum. So I just wanted to see how bad they were, and I couldn't really figure out a way of doing it without actually going up, signing up at G4S and actually joining them full-time. And I couldn't do that. I didn't have the time to do that. So when the Olympics was announced, and it was a private security company that was going to look after the entire Olympics for the first time in the Olympic history, then I thought, okay, I can get into G4S for the Olympics, and they'll do a big sort of recruitment drive. I live in a royal borough, and it was an Olympic borough, so therefore I'm more sort of, I was on a preferential list, because I lived in the borough where the Olympics were, and the government made deals so that, you know, local people would get jobs. So I thought, I can go and join them for a short period of time, and actually see in a compressed sort of environment, because obviously the Olympics is a big event, it's the most prestigious event in the country, you know, everyone was really excited. I mean, most of the locals, where I live in Greenwich, and they had the horse riding and stuff through Greenwich Park and stuff like that. It was annoying. It was a complete hassle, that's having the Olympics. But anyway, that's another story. So I went into the Olympics thinking, I'm going to actually see what their practices are like, you know, doing training for the Olympics. And I thought really to myself, look, you know, how bad can it really be? You know, maybe you'll get, you know, a few dodgy things going on, or the training not really being that good. You know, but when I arrived, it was at this school, and it was the John F. Kennedy School in Stratford, which is in East London. And this is where they were doing all the recruitment and training, and I'd been there and what have you. And for the interview, which I thought was hysterical, they kind of did a sight test, a very limited sight test. It was about two feet away almost from doing it. And then they gave me these three cups, and they said, look, what can you smell in the three cups? Right, and I kind of picked it up and I smelt it, and one was orange and one was lemonade and the other one was nothing. There was nothing in the cup, right? So I said, look, there's nothing in this cup, but it kind of smells like a plasticky, you know, plastic cup. And so she said, no, thanks very much, and ticks me off. And I said, is that it then? And I thought this was the interview. You know, I've been through, you know, like a cattle market sort of process. So this was the final interview. And she said, yeah, that's fine, right? And I kind of thought, oh my God, I've just got into the Olympics by smelling something.
Yeah, smelling a plastic cup. And that could be very, that's like a symbol, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's a real symbolic moment. So you saw you got this stuff going with Group 4. I always remember Group 4 Group 4 Securitas. They always use these Latin names just to confuse us. And they were formed from Securicor, and I remember Securicor. They were the big. They always move money from the banks, as you said. So it's essentially a sprawling conglomerate of various sub businesses that all come under the logo, and there doesn't seem to be very much proper management going on.
No, there's absolutely none, and that's what I discovered, actually, because, you know, the training was being done by, you know, ex-soldiers. So, you know, I deal with soldiers a lot. They are very good at organising huge amounts of people and getting them in lines and getting them to, you know, be in this room at this time and all this kind of stuff. So the actual building worked quite well, except the management kept sort of to another part of the school and locked themselves away. And when we were down, you know, on the floor practicing, going, you know, searching people and doing that, you know, I noticed that the metal detector didn't work. So I kind of said, hey, look, you know, the metal detector doesn't work. Is that a problem? And they went, yeah, these are like the cheapest metal detectors you can get. Anyway, because you've got to get thousands of people through the gate. So I went, sorry, can you just say that again? You're going to switch off the metal detectors. And they went, yeah, but don't tell anybody.
Right, okay, so we're getting an idea of the carry-on, like the carry-on films, the carry-on that is going on behind the scenes in what was supposed to be, like, you know, a time when, you know, people were worried about there being bombs in the Olympic Stadium and why are all those guns mounted on the buildings and all this stuff, and the metal detectors were switched off because they were rubbish.
That's right, and they, for show, really. And that they said it's security theatre, you know, it's comforting to go through and be searched. And I was like, no, it's not. And I said, I went on Tony Gosling's radio show in the UK, radio show here, and I basically said, you know, all these missiles on the roofs and the big battleship in the Thames, that's got its radar pointing around, and the martial law, the army's just brought in, all this kind of stuff. I said, you know what, a terrorist could just basically queue up, buy a ticket, and blow himself up when he gets in there. And they went, oh my God. Basically. You know?
All right, so the question is begged here. Is that because they wanted to deliberately leave holes open so that they could actually have some, quote, terrorist, some agent come in, do something, you know, drop some germ bombs or, you know, let off a bomb or something like that, in order to bring in security measures like the Patriot Act and things like that have in the States? Like, do you think that they were leaving the doors wide open for a false flag attack to happen, and then they could just easily blame G4S, which would then disband and regroup as another Phoenix company? Do you think that that's like that part of a plan, or do you think it's like just a whole cock up? Oh, what? Sorry, I don't know if we can say cock-up. It's a British term. all right, don't use that one. But do you think how much of that factor is it? Or do you think there's a deliberate policy of letting it happen on purpose kind of thing?
Well, the machines, both the you know, the metal detectors and the X-ray machines, didn't work properly, right? They weren't fit for purpose for whatever reason. They're the cheapest models. They're the whatever it is, right? And so, you know, you've got to wonder, you know, is that just, you know, what corporations do? That we'll just stick any old metal detector in. Well, I couldn't really buy that, really, because it was kind of, you know, this was the Olympics, this was the most prestigious thing. And when I was at the school training, I asked them how many of the training sites there were, and they told me around London. And there wasn't many. And I said, well, you processed about the same amount of people. And they went, yeah. And it suddenly dawned on me that with the best rule in the world, you'd have to actually start 2 years previously. Because we only started in January, and obviously in that summer, the Olympics was going to happen this year. So you'd have to start training 2 years previously to get the amount of people they wanted to be working and trained up in that stadium, right? 2 years previously. And they were starting a few months before. So I went, oh, hold on a minute. This is done on purpose, right? And I didn't really know why. And, you know, there was lots of things said during the training that was just weird and just kind of confusing, really. And so I was just kind of reporting things the best I could. And I was just wondering, you know, why is this happening? And then it kind of occurred to me, I said, well, hold on a minute, if you don't have the amount of security for the Olympics, and this was 2 weeks before the games were about to start, you're going to have to bring in the army. Now, why would you want to bring in the army? Well, it's not necessarily because something's happened in the stadium, for example. It's to acclimate us into the, you know, this, you know, new world order, this one world government system, which basically needs UN control. and NATO control. And so, you know, I thought, well, hold on a minute, how realistic is this? And I thought, you know what, they don't have the people, they're going to have to come out and say they don't have them, and the army are very nicely and very gently and smoothly going to come through, and so people are going to see army on the streets. Okay, they're not going to be armed, but, you know, they're going to be in uniform, and that's going to be part of the conditioning to get people used to seeing soldiers on the streets. And so I thought, well, this is a pretty kind of wacky idea, really. And I only kind of really halved, because, you know, as you're living these things, it's almost unbelievable to you what you're seeing and hearing and witnessing. You're taking it all in and trying to decide, well, how should I, you know, interpret what's going on? So, you know, 2 weeks beforehand, I just came out and said it. And of course, then the troops did have to come out. So what they wanted, really, was G4S was always going to fail, but they wanted to do it slowly and quietly. And, you know, they're saying, oh, well, you know, we've got the training's going well, we've kind of got the people. And then what they were going to do is kind of say, well, we've had a few short numbers, you know, not enough people or not enough great people. And so we need a few army. And, of course, that few army would have got more and more, but people wouldn't have noticed. What I did was I woke everyone up and rang the alarm bell and went, army on the streets. And, of course, you know, when they came, they were in supermarkets. Why do they need to be in supermarkets? Oh, well, they need to go out and get food. Well, the army, they live in barracks. They feed these people all the time anyway. Suddenly, they're out in the community. So what I said was true. They wanted the soldiers out there mingling amongst all the ordinary people to get ordinary people used to seeing soldiers on the streets. And so, you know, that's what I think the Olympics was about. I mean, you know, and someone said to me the other day, look, you know, nothing happened at the Olympics. And I said, well, you don't know that. As far as I was concerned, it was extremely significant moment, especially now when we see, well, look, you know, they said, you know, in the training there's going to be a defining moment in the history of this country, or in the history of London, I think it said, and I never knew what that meant. And now it's becoming apparent that because the army are being disbanded in this country, in Great Britain, from the 14th of December to the 7th of January, this is when we're expecting to see the economic crash at some point during this time. Of course, all the soldiers that are here aren't under NATO control, so they've been told to go back to the homes. They have to leave their kit and all their weapons, obviously, in the barracks. All the barracks are being shut down, and they're going to be sent, that's 110,000 people are going to be sent home. What a great way of invading another country with the United Nations blue helmet, guys, when, you know, if there's another London riot or they cause a collapse, because the economic collapse is happening anyway. So if that goes full tilt and, you know, we have what we saw, you know, with the false flag of the London riots, if that happens again, they can march blue helmets in, can't they? Because they were there for the Olympics. You know, I said they're going to bring in UN soldiers, and of course they did, and they landed. There were Australian guys they brought in. My friend got really good pictures of them and stuff, and I tried to talk to one, and they just didn't want to know. And this is what sort of invading armies do. They get other countries to sort of take you over, because obviously they don't mind shooting you. They don't know you. You're not their culture. It's a lot easier rather than the people in your own hometown who obviously won't shoot people because they, you know, they connect with them on a social level and a cultural level. So this is kind of all working into some sort of plan now. I mean, they did say that they wanted, you know, world governance by the end of 2012. And I kind of thought, well, you know, if George W. and Tony Blair and Gordon Brown and Rockefeller and, you know, Kissinger and all the people that claim this new world order is so you know, close to being done, and stuff like that. So, you know, we often get called conspiracy theorists when we talk about the New World Order, but they admit to it. So, you know, I mean, Zabrinsky said, you know, not 2 weeks ago that the New World Order was threatened. So, you know, we all better start believing that it's real, really, especially in this country, and people need to wake up to the idea. So, you know, I think, you know, not getting off the point too much, that the Olympics actually was extremely significant, because now I think, now our soldiers have been told to go home. And who sends your soldiers home for a month? I mean, they're saying it's a thank you for the Olympics. Look, I don't want to be, you know, we'll pay the extra money to keep the lights on in the barracks, because someone said it was about, you know, electricity bills or something, and that didn't wash for 1 second, and everyone just went, what? I mean, even the commanders, you know, the military guys were coming out and basically saying, so you want some people to work at home then, because they've got no holiday left, you know, and they said, oh, no, that's fine, they can work from home. And so what do you want to do? You know, set up a, you know, a jungle gym in the local park, you know, do sniper training in your back garden. I mean, it's ridiculous. So,
very interesting.
Yeah, so this is all something, and what that is basically is part of this corporate takeover that's going on, and so, you know, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't make predictions or anything like that. I only talk about what I've seen, So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if when the economic collapse happened, it would be in between the 14th of December and the 7th of January next year, you know.
Very, very interesting, Ben. That was sparked up loads of points in my mind. First one is that last night I was actually on a military base. I'm in a rock and roll band, and two of the members used to be helicopter mechanics at the RAF Lossiemouth. And so we regularly, every week I'm on a military base. It's bizarre, I know. Me with my long hair and all this. And last night we were at another base, another local base that the army has just moved into. So, And the stuff that was going on there, we saw a couple of things, but one of the things is that we went to the guard room, you know, and when we go to the normally for every time we go to the rehearsal, we have to take our passports, we have to get signed in, they take a photograph, you get a little name badge that you have to carry with you, and then when you come out, you have to put the badge back in the slot. So we're used to that kind of security, and that's, you know, I'm very happy with that, and I'm, you know, very acclimatized to that. So anyway, we went into the military barracks last night, and there are a couple of guys, they're all dressed in their uniforms and in their, you know, what they call them, the green khakis. And they got their feet up on the table and said, "Oh, you're the band. It's all right. Band have access to all areas, you know." And they literally waved us through without even looking at us. You know, we could have taken someone in and left them there and, you know, come along a few hours later with the bolt cutters. But, you know, essentially this is, you know, what I'm hearing from you, Ben, which is very worrying, is that our military is going to be replaced by something like Blackwater.
Yeah, well, that's the rest's role to do that. I mean, that's exactly what they do. You know, we've seen that now with the police here, with various forces around the country, actually employing G4S, and they're saying, well, they're only employing them in the back rooms. But look, this is the way that you take something over. When the IRA were at their sort of full tilt, really, as it was going off, what Britain decided to do was to basically bring into the military, to the British Army, Irish guys from particular areas in Northern Ireland, because they tried to infiltrate the IRA many times, and of course there were English guys trying to do an Irish accent, which isn't going to work for 1 second. And so they used to hire Irish people from certain towns and then put them into the British Army, and when they're in there for about a week, come to them and say, look, would you like to do something a bit more exciting? And then they'd feed them back out as a spy through the Force Research Unit, which was set up, which was an SAS operation, which was an intelligence unit, and they ran these, you know, they were handlers for these agents, basically, they put them back in. So what they did was they filtered so many people in through the back doors of the IRA because they wanted to go and join. And one of the guys I was speaking to who was sent by the British government to introduce himself to the IRA basically got a sort of a keg of petrol, put it on the railway tracks, and of course the military said there's a bomb and had to stop it. So he got a huge amount of praise. But he was told to do that by his handler, who was the Force Research Unit guy. And so they take you over from the inside. That's exactly what G4S are doing with our police now around the country, is they get in through the back door, so they do the administrative sort of roles, and they take care of all that kind of paperwork stuff that, you know, the police don't want to do, because they want to be out on the streets, they want to be investigating. And they take over essential services within the police. It's very clever, really. And then at some point, then the police are made to look weak, or the various mistakes that are highlighted by the government, then G4S said, well, we could do that, but we can do it for cheaper because our people cost less. So income more G4S people. And eventually what you're going to get in there, or what they want anyway, I don't know whether you're going to get it, is you'll have a policeman that basically looks like a policeman. He'll have the uniform, you know, the black and white Freemason thing. And but on his arm patch, he'll have, say, for example, G4S or Serco, or maybe Blackwater. You know, he'll have a patch identifying which corporation he's working for. I mean, you know, so that's basically how they do it and what they want to do. Now, whether they're going to do it or not, I don't think so. I mean, you know, with my sort of little stunt this summer, you know, we managed to wipe off $700 million from their share price. They're losing more contracts now than they are getting. The government are bailing them out, basically, at the moment, throwing contracts at them. But, you know, the contracts they've got around the world, because the Olympics was so horrendous, they're actually losing more contracts than they're gaining. So whether it's going to be G4S or whether it's going to be Serco or Blackwater or whomever, what another huge security company is going to be, that's, I think, what they want to do. And, of course, it's up to us now to say, oh, hold on a minute, you know, we see what's going on, we saw the shambles of what went on during the Olympics. And if people think that the police treat them badly now, just wait till private, you know, security get involved in actual policing. I mean, you know, it will be absolutely horrendous. It's a tough job being a policeman, I get it. It really is a tough gig, you know. The public aren't cooperative, they're a nightmare, they do all this kind of stuff. Yeah, but you know what, in a free country, it's good that happens. And every now and again, a policeman is going to make a mistake, like we all make mistakes, and he's going to get into trouble, and that's okay. You know, policing in a democracy should be really difficult for everybody involved. In other words, you should always be just having to think, am I breaking the law myself in trying to, you know, keep the peace? When is it the fact that, you know, I'm supporting the community to actually, you know, sort of, you know, suppressing the community? So it's a different sort of thing. So it should be a tough role. But private security, they are not going to care. All they're going to care about is getting their targets met for that month. They'll get a bonus, and so on and so forth. If they say, look, you need to go and arrest 50 people for whatever reason, they'll all go out and, you know, you may accidentally drop a piece of litter, you'll be arrested. That'll be, a certain amount of time in the G4S prison, because they also run prisons as well. That's the scary thought, you see. So for every inmate that they get now, they also get paid. So when they're the police and they own the prisons, it's going to be like Judge Dredd. You're going to have a G4S guy saying you're guilty of this on the street, go through some to the magistrate's court, which are also the magistrates are being, guess what, turned into hired through G4S, and they're, you know, magistrates are basically normal people who take an oath and what have you, and they serve and do an oath of office kind of thing. So they're becoming G4S, and G4S do all the security in the magistrate's courts as well. So you can see, you know, you'll be arrested by a G4S guy. He'll then put you through the G4S court into the G4S prison for a day or two or three or a month or 6 months or whatever it is. And that's what the future they think is going to happen. But of course, it's not going to happen because we're not going to put up with it for 1 second, you know, because, you know, they make mistakes constantly with their little plans and stuff. And they're constantly failing all the time because we keep on top of them. You know, had I not said what I said, the Olympics would have gone ahead and you would have seen those troops. And we probably wouldn't be thinking much about it now, except for the fact that, you know, their plan would have gone on a little bit further without us noticing. But because we didn't notice, we brought to everyone's attention. And that's what everyone's doing around the world. There's all these great people outing these, you know, what people would call conspiracy theories. And they're not conspiracy theories. The fact, when you put, you know, fluoride in water and you poison people, as soon as people know that that's a toxic waste, they go, oh, it's not good for your teeth. And they say, no, there's not a single study that says it's good for your teeth. Actually, there was one that was paid for by one of the fluoride poisoners corporations back in the 30s, I think it was. But, you know, when people learn this, they go, oh, my God, that's coming out my tap. Yeah, because they're medicating you through your water system. You know, when people learn about these things, and people do, and people are waking up all the time to various things like vaccines and what's the food they're eating, GMOs, they want to bring GMOs into Britain. You know, we know what GMOs are doing all over the world. We have the evidence. You know, we know what Monsanto is, that is a monster company, literally a monster company. But, you know, somehow they're trying to convince people.
And so, Ben, are we back?
Yes. We're here.
All right.
Sorry, I was talking. You probably did.
Well, I don't know whether it was my end or the Rev Radio end, so I kept on talking, so there might be a completely different archive.
Sorry.
That's right. Not your fault. So we get this all the time. It may be because of the solar winds, or, you know, conspiracy theorists among us like to imagine that it's the... that's me joining the chat rooms again. That it's the what they call the Alphabet Boys messing about. But, you know, I'm not that much of a conspiratorialist. The bleep, all gone, lost down again. We'll be back. okay, we'll be back. So, Ben.
Yeah.
What I was going to say is, the Brits owe you a debt of gratitude for being a thorn in the side. And my attitude to the powers that be is I call it the stickleback approach.
Mm-hmm.
You know what a stickleback is, don't you?
Yeah, sure. Small fish.
It's a small fish, and it's got these little spines on the back. So if the pike tries to bite it won't go in because it's a barb that goes the wrong way.
Sure.
The only thing the pike can do is to spit the fish back out again. So keep your spines nice and polished sharp.
I'm trying to, but I think it's we were actually Brian Garish from the UK column. Had a phone call yesterday from a journalist who was working for the BBC, and they wanted him to get in contact with me. I don't know why he couldn't come to me directly. I mean, I'm the easiest person in the world to contact, but anyway. So he came to Brian Garris and tried to persuade him to get me to do his show, and it was for a BBC thing, what have you. And it sounded so suspicious why they wanted it. And they basically wanted me to be on the show the same way as Stephen Mesham was on Newsnight, with the UK column being the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which was this sort of website that does sort of, journalism sort of things that's owned by, a couple of elites, as these things turn out to be. And basically what happened when Stephen Mesham came out with his story, that then McAlpine kind of, he was never mentioned, but, somehow he got himself...
That's the big joke, isn't it? McAlpine goes around suing everybody left, right and centre, and he's not even been mentioned.
Yeah.
He thinks he does protest too much.
Well, actually, I learned from the weekend, I had an insider from the Levinson Inquiry call me up, and basically explained to me why McAlpine got a payout. And then they basically said, look, Levinson is going to be the head of this new entity, this new ministry of, this press arbiter that they're setting up. And what it's going to do is that if you're an elite person, you're a famous person, or whatever, you can go to the press arbiter, run by the Lord Justice Ministries or whatever it is, and say, hey, look, I've been, this paper's treating me badly, this TV show's treating me badly, go and get them. And so what the Levinson thing's going to do is go to the newspaper and get you a large payout. That's what they're being trained to think. So all the big guys now, from the BBC to all the papers, go, oh, if we do say something or even imply, because nothing, Stephen Mesham never mentioned Lord McAlpine in any way whatsoever on air, and that's the only reason you get a payout, really. I was abused by the BBC. I didn't get anything. many other people were. They didn't make anything. But they're proving that. They're saying, look, this is how you're going to deal with us. So Levinson's going to come to you and bark at you, and you're going to pay him money, and then that portion's going to go to Levinson, and a portion's going to come back to you. It's a racket. It's another layer, And
another layer of scam by these paedophilic... I can't even... Yeah, no, I'm trying to think of nice words. But anyway, yeah, it's another layer of scam to try and get money out of people. And, I'm amazed that, the BBC just kind of coughed up. Everybody just coughed up. paid out to McAlpine, who's already pretty rich.
Yeah, well, that's what they were... But, he was there to take some flack. I mean, he wrote a book called The New Machiavelli, I think it was, and in a chapter of it, he told you how to sort of, get money for yourself, basically how to get a payout. And it was kind of create full sympathy for yourself by getting yourself accused of something that isn't true now, and then create public sympathy for it. And then, you can get, you're going to sue everyone, they're going to lose much more, but then you get a payout, something less. He actually wrote all this in his book, which was terrible. Which is unbelievable. And we saw Levinson in Australia. He goes to Australia, and just coincidentally, we get two Australian radio DJs who call up, Kate Middleton and try and get some information from the nurse, and then, the nurse has committed suicide, so it's horrific. But the thing is that Levinson gets to put in almost like a world law, he can then say, well, the same thing's happening in Britain, it's happening in Australia, and try and get the Australians to clamp down on broadcasting, because that's what really it's about. You know, when people have been talking about this nurse, what I've been sort of saying is, look, you know, what we've got to sort of decide, it's not really about these two radio DJs, really. It's about having a conversation about what was a nurse that was clearly sort of disturbed individual doing, looking after a member of the royal family in the first place, if they've committed suicide after doing something relatively minor, which was putting a call through. This wasn't the nurse that gave out all the information. It was just that. So I kind of think, well, again, conversation's been hijacked, hasn't it, by Levinson, by saying about press freedom in Australia and getting away with breaking the rules, which they didn't do, by the way. None of those DJs did. It was fair game what they did in their own country. You know, they shouldn't really be, you know, brought onto all the front pages and berated. And those poor people, you know, they're both, you know, just people trying to get along, do their job. Yeah, okay, every now and again, comedy is not going to work out. Some people are going to get sort of upset by it. Of course, you know, suicide apart, you know, that's obviously an extreme thing that's happened. But I think it's actually a different story, you know. I don't see, you know, I'm sure she was absolutely devastated, and I don't want to speak about her really or her family, and, you know, I wish the family well, and, you know, my condolences to the family and everything like that, but, you know, it does actually have to be asked, what was somebody doing, you know, who was clearly disturbed, looking after members of the royal family? And maybe that's not a question for us, maybe that's a question for the hospital, but again, it's something that I was kind of posing over the weekend, talking to people about it and stuff, because people just don't seem to understand it. Was it a Levinson thing, or was it, you know, a story about sort of a prank gone wrong, or, you know, it's confusing. So the narrative, really, of the whole thing doesn't really make sense. So I was very fortunate to get a phone call over the weekend that basically let me know that I was going to be the poster child for the clampdown on the internet in this country, the same way as the radio DJs, and the same way that Stephen Mesham has been for the BBC and the press and what have you. You know, I thought I'd publish the article and basically just try and tell it as straight as I could to try and give myself some protection, you know, before it all started. And then this guy from the BBC, which was a very strange phone call to Brian Gerrish of the UK Column, came on Monday. So actually, when that person called me, and I won't name them because they've been gagged by Levinson, so they were still breaking the rules that Levinson imposed after Shami Chakrabarti made her sort of statements about, you know, she's not feeling happy about it. Well, she doesn't feel happy about it because it's the wrong thing to do. And it's the same with a lot of these people now in these kind of, you know, they can see the racket going on, they can see the corruption, and they want out now because they know, actually, this isn't what I signed up for. This has been twisted in some way. And as we see with every story that happens now, it's always twisted. So, you know, it's very difficult for people to actually see the truth. So I'm just laying it out for people as it happens to me, so that if something happens to me, and by the way, I'm never going to commit suicide. I'm not a suicide risk. You know, I don't plan to commit suicide. And if I do commit suicide, it's murder. I have to say that, right? Just to have it on the record.
Absolutely. Have it on the record that it's this is a method. I mean, we saw it happening with David Kelly. He was unable to do what he was supposed to have done. David Kelly was a weapons inspector who was apparently he was what we call suicided, you know, through another contact and through other things, you know, it was a suicide job, which means that they killed him. And I've got this feeling, just to be, you know, to put my tinfoil hat right on and fit it firmly across my ears, is that this nurse had the same process as a kind of warning to people, don't mess with these royals.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, no, these things.
Oh, that's the end of the show. Ben Fellows, thank you very much. I would love to have you back on another time, if you're up for it, to give us updates. Would you like to come on back on? Thank you very much. I'll see you all down the road.